Well, it is wonderful to be with you. And after a mild heart attack, it's wonderful to be anywhere, you know. It's I'll tell you, I checked into this one hospital, and they told me that what they needed to do on my heart, they don't do in that hospital, so they had to transfer me to another one. So I'm in this ambulance, you know, sort of facing out the ambulance, you know, on roads that I know really well. I've driven on them many times, and I'm thinking, I'm in an ambulance. And there are these cars, you know, right behind me. And I was thinking, wouldn't this just be the wildest thing if somebody pulled up behind me who knows me? Hey, it's me. I'm in an ambulance. I'm having a heart attack right now. But nobody pulled up behind me that I knew, at least. And it was wonderful to get anywhere. So I am thrilled to discuss this topic of evangelism. I imagine some of you are thinking, perhaps when you heard that the topic tonight was evangelism, you might be thinking, maybe there's some other place I could be. It's not always everybody's favorite topic. As a matter of fact, I find that most people really are not too comfortable with this. So let me just start by telling you, neither am I. I'm not an evangelist. I think most of us, most Christians, are not evangelists. Let me just get an idea, by the way. How many of you here in this room would say that your main gift from God is the gift of evangelism? How many? Oh, my. Wow. I'm among friends. This is great. Okay. Well, none. I would have thought there might be. Usually it's 10% or less, or, you know, but so, okay. So this is good. Let me ask you a different question. How many of you would say that you think evangelism is easy? Oh, there we go. There's one. What? Oh, a few. Okay, good. Very good. You can leave. No, don't. No. This might be boring, but, you know, I'll try to do my best. So, no, I think for the vast majority of Christians, it's very difficult. Now, here's the problem. Many, many people who speak about evangelism and who write about evangelism are evangelists. And for them, it's easy. It's like breathing. They just can't imagine not doing it. And so they say things that just make the other 99% of us feel really bad. They say things like, I cannot sleep at night unless I have witnessed that day. And the rest of us go, I sleep just fine. Or they say, every time I get on an airplane, I start praying for the person who's going to sit next to me, and I pray that I can boldly proclaim the gospel. And a lot of us say, when I get on a plane, I pray for an empty seat. More room to spread out. Ah, this is comfortable. So we just feel bad when these speakers speak or when we read their books. And they use words like easy, simple, every day. And we think, if it could, you know, like occasionally would be a miracle for me. So here's what I want to do tonight. I want to talk about evangelism for non-evangelists. Are we at home, right? This would be most of us, right? I want to talk about... See, the trick is, though, non-evangelists are still called by God to do evangelism, right? You read Paul's letter to Timothy, the second letter, and he says to him to do the work of an evangelist. Now, we read about Timothy, and we find out that he was a very kind of shy, quiet, timid kind of guy. And yet, God was calling him also to do the work of an evangelism, even though the bulk of his gifts were in the lines of shepherding and discipling and pastoral ministry. God calls all of us to proclaim the gospel. And we all want to, I think. The more we get to know this God, the more we marvel at how wonderful his message is, the more we want to tell people. We really do. So let's try to figure out how can we non-evangelists break through that barrier and start talking to our friends and our neighbors and our relatives and our coworkers so that they too can be joining us in gatherings like this, praising and worshiping the Almighty God that we love and serve. Part of the problem also is that our world is changing so dramatically, so rapidly, and moving so very radically away from a Christian frame of reference. Here in our country, for much of the time that our country has existed, we have had a Christian frame of reference at least kind of overshadowing everything that went on. And so even people who were not Christians at least kind of saw reality from those starting points. But many people today do not have anything near a Christian frame of reference. Here's how I like to illustrate it. When my oldest son, Dan, was in high school, he's now out of college, but when he was in high school, he started coming home from high school with this theory about how everything in the world worked. If you know my son Dan, this doesn't surprise you. He's very global in thinking. He can explain everything that ever happens, ever. More than you want him to. And so he said, Dad, everything that happens in the world can be explained by the plug theory. The plug theory. Now, if you understand the plug theory, you'll never read the newspapers the same way. You'll never watch the TV news. You will understand everything. So you ready? Here it is. This is The Secret to Understanding Everything by Dan Newman. Okay. The plug theory says that every country has, somewhere near its geographic center, a big plug holding it up. If somebody were to somehow pull the plug, the country would sink. There it is. That's the whole thing right there. Ours, he's pretty sure, is somewhere in the middle of Kansas. And so it is in a country's absolute top highest priority to keep its plug secure. And in fact, to keep the secret, I mean, the location of it a secret. In fact, Dan believes there is a worldwide conspiracy denying the very existence of the plugs. So the fact that you've never heard of this theory is proof that it's true. Some of you, I hope, at this moment are desperately praying for that young man. Yes, that would be good. But ours, like I said, is somewhere in the middle of Kansas, probably not far from the military base in Fort Leavenworth. In fact, he thinks it's probably within the perimeter of the military base, which is why the security at Leavenworth Penitentiary is so very strong, because it's so close to the plug. Switzerland's plug is probably the most secure in all the world because it's high atop the Swiss Alps, which is why Switzerland has always been neutral in so many wars. What have they got to lose? No one's going to pull their plug. He goes on and on, far more than, okay, enough already, Dan. Atlantis, the lost colony of Atlantis, obviously didn't guard its plug very well. And one day, he even came home from a high school youth group meeting. He said, Dad, I found the plug theory in the Bible. You don't need to turn here, believe me. But in Genesis chapter 7, in that whole narrative about Noah and the flood, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth and the floodgates of the heaven were open. He said, Dad, God pulled all the plugs at once, right there. That's how the flood was. Okay, why in the world am I telling this silly story? Well, here's why. None of you believed that, did you? At least I hope not. I won't ask for a show of hands. Sometimes I do this, by the way, and some people start taking notes, but very quickly they realize... Sorry. But none of you took notes all the way through it. After a very short period of time, you thought, this isn't real. You didn't make notes to write to your congressman, keep our plug secure. No, you thought that this cute little plug theory story was amusing, but not the least bit believable. You thought it was entertaining a little bit, but not plausible. And in fact, if I were to keep going longer about it, it would not make you more likely to believe it. It would only make you more likely to feel sorry for me. Enough already. What am I trying to say? Our world has changed so dramatically today that I believe for many of the people in our world today, many of your friends, many of your neighbors, many of the people you go to class with or work with or live near, may be as likely to believe the gospel as they are to believe the plug theory. It's just so far-fetched from what they think. It is so far from their frame of reality of what is true and what is right and what is good and what is desirable. And so the task of evangelism, I believe, has become a little bit more difficult in the last 50 years. I'm not trying to say this to discourage you. I'm trying to say this so that you'll be realistic. The gospel message hasn't changed in 2,000 years. At all. But the way we present it may be different in that the world around us no longer shares the starting points that we hold to be true. The things that we just sang about God and his nature being good and righteous and holy, and that we are sinful and separated from God, and that God in his incredible, unspeakable mercy and grace came to die the death that we should have died, so that we can live a life that we could never have possibly lived otherwise. It's an amazing thing, but all of those are like pillars in our lives, and our world around us doesn't share any of them. So the task of evangelism, I think, involves not just declaring the truth and not just defending the truth, but I think dialoguing the truth. Did you catch it? We need to know how to be able to declare the gospel. Okay, John just said that at this church, a lot of you have learned how you could communicate the gospel in 1 minute. Great. That is wonderful. And if you don't know that, I encourage you to get that kind of training. So that if someone said to you, well, no, what is it that you believe, that you could tell them without having to kind of make it up on the spot, without kind of stumbling along, but in a short, concise way, you could declare the gospel. That is an essential, important skill in your life. Secondly, we also need the skill of knowing how to defend the gospel, how to answer common questions, how to answer the things that people are throwing at us today. And the attacks are coming more and more frequently, aren't they? But what I want to say is we also need a third skill, not just declaring the gospel, not just defending the gospel, but dialoguing the gospel. Knowing how to make it a back and forth kind of conversation. Knowing how to engage people in the thinking process so that they move along with us. And for some people, that's a 30-minute conversation. For some people, it's a 5-minute conversation. For some people, it's 6 months. For some people, it's several years. And what we want to do is we want to be equipped and ready to be able, whatever is the need of that situation and that person. And what I tend to talk a great deal about is the use of questions. How do we ask questions? How do we answer questions? How do we answer questions with questions? How do we make the question and answer conversation kind of thing such an engaging thing that can move people from the greatest amount of unbelief gradually more and more to acceptance and belief and joining us in praise and wonder? You know, I did a study not too long ago and in the process of writing the first book about how Jesus responded to questions. I had a hunch that it might be a little bit different, but I started kind of keeping track. I took out a piece of paper, drew a line down the middle, and on one side I wrote, you know, where people asked Jesus a question, and then I wrote how he responded. I ended up with 9 or 10 pages full of notes. And what intrigued me was how very often he didn't answer. It was amazing to me how very unusual it was when he just sort of gave a straight answer. Most of the time, he answered questions with questions. Many of the times, he avoided the question. Sometimes he kind of said something that was so totally surprising that the person, what, huh? But this answering a question with a question thing was his most common and favorite device. Do you remember when people came to Jesus and they said, is it lawful for us to heal on the Sabbath? You remember this? And he said, well, if you had an animal that fell into the ditch, wouldn't you pull it out? Why did he do that? Well, because it engages the person in the answering process, so he doesn't even have to state the answer. Or when they said to him, is it lawful for us to pay taxes? And he says, let me see a coin. Whose face is on the coin? Or they said, is it okay for us to get a divorce? He said, what did Moses write? It's amazing. Jesus always, not always, but so very often answered a question with a question. Now, by the way, this did not come as any kind of unusual thing for me. I grew up with this. I come from a Jewish background, and Jewish people always answer questions with questions. We don't know how to answer questions. You call that a question? I mean, it's built in. It's a little sick, actually, but I remember vividly conversations like this. Grandma, how's the weather down there? How could the weather be in Florida? Uncle Murray, how are you doing? Why do you ask? How's your family compared to who? I mean, it's just, you know, it's nonstop. So when I would read about Jesus answering questions with questions, I felt at home. But, you know, I just was so intrigued about how it would grab people. See, so very often people ask questions like this. And if you just give them an answer, even if it's the right answer, even if it's the biblically sound, doctrinally watertight, philosophically solid, you know, they're still like this. But when you answer a question with a question, it gets them involved. And their mind and their heart comes along. One of the most stunning examples of this, I think, in Jesus' life was when that rich man came to him. It's recorded in Mark chapter 10 and a couple other places. But the guy comes to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Remember that? Can you think of a better question? Can you think of a better straight line, a lead-in to the gospel? I sometimes imagine that the disciples were in the background, you know. Let them have it. Tell them. Take out the booklet. Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? You couldn't have asked for a better question, a lead-in to the gospel. And what does Jesus say? There, why do you call me good? Now can't you picture the disciples? Oh, he blew it. Oh, man. It's a perfect setup. And then Jesus makes it worse. He says to the guy, "No one is good except God alone." And you think, what is he trying to do to this guy? Trying to scare him away? This is not a way to attract converts. What was he doing? You read the rest of that dialogue and you know what was going on in that guy's heart. He said, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And as you read the rest of the dialogue, you see this guy already thought he was good. Right? When Jesus quoted just some of the commandments, what did the guy say? He said, "All these things I've kept since I was a youth." Can you think of anything more arrogant, more self-sufficient, more self-right? "I've kept all the commandments. I've never done anything wrong." You know, I put myself into that scenario and I think I would have let the guy have it. Oh, yeah? You know what Mark records in that telling? Mark says that Jesus looked at the man and loved him. Stunning. And he carries on a dialogue that is very disturbing to that man. And an interaction of question and answer leads that man to that painful reality. Oh, no, I'm not good. Oh, my goodness. No one is good except God alone. And it says that the man went away sad. Some of our conversations may go in a direction that may not necessarily feel comfortable, but may be incredibly powerful and life-changing and redemptive for people. So what's our goal? To be comfortable in evangelism? I'm hoping I've shot that one out of the water. That's not a very good goal for most of us. Is our goal to be obnoxious? I hope not. Our goal is to help people move closer to the cross. Let's look at one passage of Scripture, and then I'm going to offer to you a number of, I hope, practical suggestions. But if you brought a Bible, I invite you to open up to Acts chapter 17. I want you to see that this wasn't just Jesus' example, as if there would be anything bad about that. But Paul also used this, and I think we can learn some things from the way Paul embodied this questioning and answering kind of method. Acts chapter 17, we're going to look at the first five verses. If you'll give me just a second. Acts chapter 17 begins this way. When they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. As his custom was, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. "This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Christ," he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and not a few prominent women. But the Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace. They formed a mob and started a riot in the city. Now we'll stop there, and I'm not going to do a thorough study of this. I just want to point out a few observations and then try to see if we can connect them to our situation. Excuse me. The first is, I hope you saw that it says on three Sabbath days. That means Paul went back to the same place more than once. We know from the study of the book of Acts and other sources of history that Paul went back to some places many times. In one place, he stayed for over a year. What that tells me is that Paul must have felt that sometimes evangelism takes more than one shot. See, what I'm trying to say is that like Paul's, our evangelism may be more ongoing process rather than just one-shot proclamation. I think a lot of us have learned about evangelism and see it as a one-shot event. And I think given the realities of our culture today and what we learn now about how people learn and understand things, it may take several installments. So let's not get impatient and let's start getting a three Sabbath days kind of mentality rather than a one and only one shot deal. Second observation, I hope you saw or hope you heard the kinds of verbs that are used in this passage. He reasoned, he explained, he proved. Some of the people were persuaded. This is these are process kinds of verbs. There's an involvement in this of a process. It's not just all instantaneous. What I'm trying to say is that like Paul's, our evangelism may be more dialogue rather than just declaration. It may be more ongoing rather than just instantaneous. That word there, the very first one, he reasoned with them. He reasoned with them from the scriptures. That phrase is used several times in this very chapter and in other places. That was Paul's mode of operation. He reasoned with the scriptures. It's a lovely combination. It's using human wisdom and thinking and reasoning skills, but it is combining with God's supernatural revelation. He reasoned from the scriptures. The Revised Standard Version translated this, he argued from the scriptures. Now we don't necessarily like that word because we think, in our culture, we think argue means something angry or hostile or out of control, but it doesn't have to be. There is a kind of holy arguing that we need to become good at, and I hope to be able to share with you a couple of ways to do that. But I want you to see there's a kind of back and forth nature to evangelism that we need to get good at. Third, I want you to see, like Paul's, our evangelism might get mixed reviews. Did you catch that? Some people believed, some people wanted to have a riot. I would call that mixed reviews. No surprise, everywhere Paul went, he got those kind of mixed reviews, right? In fact, pretty much everywhere Jesus went, he got those mixed reviews, didn't he? Some people said, we'll drop our fishing nets, we will follow him anywhere. Other people said, he's demon-possessed, let's throw him off a cliff. I'd call that mixed reviews. I would say that's going to be the response that we're going to get, so let's not be surprised by it. And the fourth thing I want to point out is, I think, the reason for that. And that is the very essence of this message that we're trying to tell people. Did you catch the phrase, what is it? He reasoned, he explained, he proved what? That the Messiah, here comes the most important words, had to suffer and rise from the dead. Had to suffer and rise from the dead. Let's see, how do I put this? Like Paul's, our evangelism might be bad news before it's good news. The gospel has an element of bad news before it can seem like good news. That's why it gets mixed reviews. Some people don't like the bad news. The bad news, the way it's worded in this text, is that the Messiah had to suffer. Had to. It was necessary. Let's try to think of it this way. It would not have been enough if the Messiah just came and taught us some things to do. Now, he did. He did teach us. Better than anybody has ever taught. His lessons were the best ones ever. But if all the Messiah did was teach us things to do, we really wouldn't be able to do them, would we? Turn the other cheek? Love your enemy? Can you do those things? In fact, Jesus told us a lot of things to do that if all we had were just his lessons, we would be really miserable. Let's try to look at it another way. If it would not have been enough for the Messiah just to come and give us an example. Did Jesus turn the other cheek? Did Jesus love his enemies? Sure. Did Jesus give us an example? Sure. The best one ever given, by far. But if that's all we had, we would really be miserable. Because there's nobody who can possibly live up to it. We can't do it. What we need is not just a Messiah who teaches, and not just a Messiah who gives us an example. We need a Messiah who dies. Who dies a death for us, who atones for us, who pays the price for our sin. That breaks us. That changes us. That transforms us and makes us the kind of people who want to do the things that he said and who can, by his power and his mercy and his grace, can obey and follow the example. But without that death, it's pretty miserable. So what we need is this kind of message that has at first a bad news message that says your sin is really bad. It's so bad you can't clean it up. It's so bad it needs somebody else to pay the price for you. Wait, it's even worse than that. It's so bad that the only one who could possibly pay a price that would do any good for you is God himself. And when people grapple with that, it's very disturbing. It has to be. But when they do, it can lead them then to the greatness of, and that's exactly what happened. My sin is so bad that Christ had to die for me, but his love for me is so great that he was glad to die for me. So, that's why evangelism is difficult. But that's why evangelism is wonderful. That's why it's worth it. That's why it's worth all the discomfort and all of the, oh, I'm not really an evangelist, and it's worth all of the opposition that you'll feel within and from without. It's worth it because when people get this, they're set free. So, let me try to offer to you a couple of ideas about how to make this practical. This has all been very nice and theoretical. I hope you've enjoyed that. Now let's try to be practical. Let's see how I'm going to do this. What I'd like to do is offer to you four principles to remember and then four questions to ask. Now, these are not magic questions. These are not the only four. They're not the most important four. All I'm trying to do now is just kind of spark your thinking so that it raises a million other ideas and a million other questions. So I'm just trying to paint four different pictures that you might find yourself in. Four different things that people will say, four different principles for you to remember, and then here's some questions. But again, these aren't the magic ones. I want you to think, okay, just start putting yourself in a whole variety of situations. And well, what could I say there? What could I ask there? Okay? So, four principles to remember and some four questions to kind of throw around. The first principle to remember, I think, is that some people in our day and age aren't even awake. I was not making any statement about any of you, but if the person next to you is asleep, this would be the time to hit them with your elbow. Okay? Good, we took care of that. No, what I mean is, I don't mean physically asleep. I mean mentally. I mean emotionally. I mean spiritually. There's just a whole lot of mindlessness in our culture today. There's not a whole lot of thinking going on. We don't like to think. It's disturbing to us. It might mess up watching television. And so So there's just a whole lot of rather silly things that are said. For example, people may say, I'm sure you've heard people say this, hey, it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you're happy. Doesn't matter what you can believe anything you want, as long as it works for you. Hey, listen, who am I to judge? You can believe anything you want, as long as it works for you. If it works for you, great, I'm happy for you. Right? People have said that? Give me some kind of, there we go, okay, that's good. The universal sign that, yes, we know what the speaker's talking about is like this. Okay, good, good. People say that stuff all the time, and it's crazy. It's nonsense. It's ridiculous. But I don't think you should say any of those things. Don't say, that's stupid. I don't think that's a good witnessing line. I think it's better to ask a question. When people say these kind of silly, nonsensical things that make you think that they're not even awake, it's better to ask a question to gently wake them up. And here's my favorite question to use. You ready? You might want to write this down. It's, really? That's it. The whole thing. Okay, maybe you elaborate. Do you really think so? You really believe that? By the way, you should practice this one in front of a mirror because it has the temptation to be rather sarcastic. Oh, really? So you want to work on it. But you want to gently wake people up when they say things that show that there's not really a whole lot of brainwaves going on. Oh, you know, you can believe anything you want. You want to say, well, really? You really think anything's okay? You remember, like, not too long ago, there was this religious cult that thought that when this particular comet went by that they should all kill themselves. This is true. And they did. They all killed themselves right at this moment. You think that was okay? I mean, they were sincere, you know, and, you know, you think that kind of stuff is all right? You think when people, for religious reasons, crash planes into buildings to kill people, you think that's okay? You don't think that's okay, do you? Well, see, now what you did was you kind of woke them up, and now you got them in the world of the awake and the thinking. I'm not the, you know, I love what C.S. Lewis wrote about this in his book, The Screwtape Letters. You know that book? Have you read that? For those of you who haven't, The Screwtape Letters is supposedly this fictitious collection of letters from one demon to another. One senior demon raising up a young trainee about how to mess up Christians. So you have to read the whole book sort of upside down. I mean, everything that the demon says is bad is really good. Everything he says is good is really bad. You got it? Have I confused you? Anyway, so he talks about our Father below. That's the devil. Boo. The enemy is God. You understand? Okay, in the very first letter, here's what he says. Some of you will get this about like an hour from now on your way home. Oh, I see. Okay, so. All right, so here's what this demon says to his young trainee. It sounds as if you suppose that argument was the way to keep him out of the enemy's clutches, God's hands. That might have been so if he had lived a few centuries earlier. At that time, the human still knew pretty well when a thing was proved and when it was not. And if it was proved, they really believed it. They still connected thinking with doing and were prepared to alter their way of life as the result of a chain of reasoning. But what with the weekly press and other such weapons, we have largely altered that. Your man has become accustomed, ever since he was a boy, to having a dozen incompatible philosophies dancing about together inside of his head. He doesn't think of doctrines as primarily true or false, but as academic or practical, outworn or contemporary, conventional or ruthless. Listen, listen, listen. Jargon, not argument, is your best enemy, your best ally in keeping him from the church. The trouble with argument is that it moves the whole struggle onto the enemy's own ground. Catch it? We live in an incredibly thoughtless and mindless and, I'm sorry to use the word, stupid culture, where people don't want to think at all. We just want to be entertained. The less thinking, the better. And so we come along and we want to appeal to people's logic and reason that is God-given. God has planted it in them. And we're trying to awaken something that has probably been asleep for a long time. But we need to do it anyway. That's what Paul did in Acts chapter 17. In a number of places, that's what Paul did in his famous sermon in the city of Athens, where he appealed to very, very intelligent people who were used to kicking around arguments all day long, and he was trying to use that argument to lead them that the argument of Scripture was the best argument. Jesus did this all the time when he would appeal to people and say, now, you know, you understand how you treat your children. Well, wouldn't God treat you in the same way? You being evil would, right? He's appealing to logic and reason, and so we need to learn how to use that kind of holy argument logic in behalf of the gospel. So, some people aren't awake, and we should awaken them with, really? Do you really think so? Second principle to keep in mind is that some things can't be true. This is similar to the first, but some things just cannot be true. They will not stand up to argument. And so what we need to do is gently try to show people that if they keep thinking this way, it will lead to something absurd or meaningless. For example, some people may say to you, you know, I think all religions are basically the same. Right? You've heard this? I think all religions, at their heart, are really kind of saying the same thing. You know, they differ in some of the externals, but at their core, they're really saying the same thing. Well, they're not. You don't need a degree in comparative religion to know this. You just study some basic things about Judaism and Buddhism and Islam, and they're saying very different things about some of the most crucial central things of their faith. Some of you have charts. You know what I'm talking about? These charts, you pull them out, and there's, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and what these religions teach about God, about people, about life. You know, do any of you know what I'm talking about? Anyway, there are these charts. They're really good. I hope you like them and use them, but don't use them in evangelism. They don't work so well. I wish I was just speaking theoretically, but I know from firsthand experience that, look, you're wrong is not a good approach. Take my word for it, please. See, some things just can't be true, but a question leads people to that much better. And so what we want to gently do, see, so very often non-Christians like to put us on the defensive. What we need to learn how to do is to gently put them on the defensive. And here's one of the best ways. You say, can you explain that to me? Can you help me understand that? I don't get that. I don't see how Buddhism and Judaism are saying the same thing about anything. You might say, as I think I could say, I used to believe that. And then I did a little bit of reading and found, oh, no, they're really not saying the same things. In fact, if you take these different religions to their logical extensions, you will end up with very, very different kinds of people and very, very different kinds of societies, as we have in our world today. So when people say things that can't be true, what we want to do is logically use questions to get them to that point where they realize, you know what? I can't defend what I've been believing. We want them to come to that painful place, like that guy that came to Jesus, where he comes and he realizes, oh, I'm not okay. All the religions aren't teaching the same things. I can't just sort of dismiss them all. I've got to look at them and really wrestle with them. All right, third principle, and this one's very important, but it's the most difficult. So I don't know exactly the best way to do this, but let me just say, some questions aren't sincere. Some questions that people ask you are not real questions. They're attacks. They're mocking you. They're ridiculing you. And it's very important that you don't treat all questions as if they're sincere, because they're not. There are times when Jesus didn't answer people. I know, this is where, by the way, where my Jewishness becomes the most pronounced in the room. Because Jewish people are very fine with not answering questions. We're very comfortable with arguing. You know, we have no qualms whatsoever with saying things like, that's crazy. But Gentiles, I find, are a little more uncomfortable with this. So let me just say, and by the way, to add, to make this worse, is I'm originally from New York. So a New York Jew. So whatever you need to do to translate this to Maryland Gentile, do it, okay? But I don't want you to think, oh, that's just that crazy New York Jew talking. No. Listen, here's what the book of Proverbs said in chapter 26, verses 4 and 5, verses right next to each other, which some people think of, wait a minute, this sounds like a contradiction. It's not, but listen. Proverbs 26:4 says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself. There's times when it's wise not to answer. Someone makes this attack, you know, to you. So I suppose you're telling me that everybody disagrees with you is going to hell. And you could, by joining in with their sarcasm and tone of voice, just become a fool like them yourself. Oh, so you're telling me that you don't believe? And so now you're not, it's not a real discussion. It's two fools. On the other hand, the very next proverb says, answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. Remember when the people came to Jesus? This is toward the end of the Gospels. They came to him. He was teaching in the temple. And they said, by whose authority are you doing this? Was that a real question? No, it was an attack. They wanted to embarrass him in front of all people. They wanted to discredit him. It wasn't a real question. By whose authority are you doing this? Remember what Jesus said? He said, well, let me ask you a question. There he goes again. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from men? Do you remember this? Remember what they did? They said, give us a minute. And they had a little private council. And they came over by themselves. They said, okay, now listen, if we say it was from heaven, then he's going to say, well, then why didn't you believe John? But if we say it was from men, well, it's like all these people who like John will have a riot. That's a paraphrase. And so they come back, and what do they say to Jesus? We don't know. And what did Jesus say? Then neither will I answer your question. There are times when people ask you questions that they're not real questions. And you've got to learn, by the discerning power of the Holy Spirit who dwells inside believers, you've got to learn, sometimes the response needs to be, well, let's really get to the heart of this. So that question that I just posed a few minutes ago. So you ever hear anybody say this to you? So are you telling me that everybody who disagrees with you is going to hell? You guys are the only ones going to heaven? Right? You've had people say things like that to you, I think, haven't you? It's very popular in our culture today. Oh, you guys think you have a corner on the market of truth. You're the only ones going. Now, are those, there is a real question somewhere underneath that. And for someone who asks it sincerely, you want to be equipped to answer that question. But for someone who's just being sarcastic and mocking you, they're not ready to hear. So you can quote John 14:6 to them. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. And yes, that's the right answer, but they're not ready to hear it yet. I was in a dorm room. And believe me, the reason I know this is because I've done it wrong so many times. I've answered people who are not asking sincere questions, and it doesn't do any good. In fact, it makes them wise in their own eyes. Some people have said, are you telling me that everybody who disagrees with you is going to hell? Well, yeah. John 14:6, and here's a couple of arguments. And what do? They just walk away thinking, yep, I knew it. You're an idiot. I thought you were a narrow-minded bigot, and I was right. So I started experimenting with trying a different approach. And so this one time I was in a dorm room at George Mason University, not far from here, not far from where I live. This guy was, it was this Bible study. Every week we had this Bible study in this guy's dorm room. And every week this one guy whose room we met in would tell me about his atheist roommate, who never came to the Bible study. But his atheist roommate asked this question, how would I respond? Well, one week the atheist showed up with like six of his friends, all atheists. So it was like all the atheists over here, all the Christians over here, and Randy the Crusader in the middle. It was about 4,000 degrees in the room, as I recall. So this guy sitting right here says to me, so are you telling me that everybody who disagrees with you is going to hell? And I thought, this isn't a real question. This isn't a sincere question. This is a fool attacking me, and I don't want to leave him wise in his own eyes. I don't want to just join in his folly and be like him. So I tried something different. I said, well, do you believe in hell? It's like, do you believe in hell? And he said, well, no, I think the whole idea of hell is ridiculous. And so I said, so why do you care? You know, I share that, and almost always people laugh, but nobody laughed in that dorm room, let me tell you. It's like, what? I said, why do you care? If there's no such place as hell, why do you care who I think goes there? It's okay to confuse people a little. You're trying to get them to think. This guy's never thought about heaven and hell. He really hasn't. Is there a more important topic for people to wrestle with? I don't know. I think that's pretty high up there. Do you believe in hell? Well, no. I said, what do you care? Well, quickly, one of his atheist friends jumped in. Well, I do believe in hell. Oh, okay, good. We agree on that. Wow, that's good. Do you think anybody's there? Huh? Do you think anybody's in hell? Now, that's very uncomfortable for people, so I helped him. I said, Hitler. You think Hitler's in hell? Isn't this bizarre, by the way, a Jewish guy using Hitler to talk about Jesus? If that doesn't give you a headache, I don't know what will. What? What? You think Hitler's in? Yeah, I think so. Oh, okay, good. We agree. Another thing we agree on. You think anybody else is there? Well, yeah, probably. You believe in heaven? Yeah, I think so. Okay, good. You think anybody's there? Yeah, I think so. Oh, good. Okay. So you think some people go to heaven and some people go to hell? Well, yeah. All right. Who decides? Well, I guess God does. That's what he said. God. I thought, you just told me you were an atheist. I didn't point that out. Didn't. Don't point that out. Said, okay, I'm with you. All right. So how do you suppose God decides who goes to heaven and who goes to hell? Now, by the way, all of this thinking is very, very important. It's far more important than anything I'm going to say. If I can get this person wrestling with, is there a heaven? That's a really big step. Finally, he said, well, I don't know, maybe like, I guess about the Ten Commandments. Okay, that's a very, very common answer. All right, good, I like those ten. I'm in favor of them. Do you think you have to get all ten right to get in? Well, I mean, like, does God grade on a curve? I mean, I don't know. See, now we're ready to have a real discussion. See, now he's wrestling with, no one's good except God alone. I moved, with those questions, those guys moved from, I don't believe in God and I think you're an idiot, And I think what you believe is the stupidest thing in the world to, maybe I need to think about this. And that leads me to my fourth point, and that is sometimes a partial victory is best. What have I said? I've said that some people aren't awake. We should wake them up with questions like, really? Some things can't be true, and we should turn it on them and say, can you explain that to me? Some questions are insincere, and we need to wrestle. I don't have a simple little formula to do that, but I think we need to be ready to get involved in that. And the most important, I think, of all of these is that sometimes a partial victory is best. Sometimes moving people from total unbelief to, gee, maybe I ought to think about this, is a great conversation. Let me try to put it to you like this. I usually do this. Imagine that behind me there's this big line just in the air, okay? Imagine there's this line, and it's got the alphabet on it, okay? So right here is the letter A, right? And we got A, B, C, D, all the way down over here to Z, okay? You all with me? I'm doing this to so you have to move. This is like to wake you up. It's good. So Z, let's say that this A to Z scale is, A is unbelief of the most extreme, okay? That's the most hardened atheist you can imagine. And Z is the person who's ready to become a Christian. Where do I go to be baptized? Okay, that's Z. All right? I think a whole lot of us have thought about evangelism and have learned about evangelism and have talked about it with the assumption that when we start a conversation with people, that they're somewhere around T. And all we need to say to them is T-U-V-W-X-Y-Z, and they're in. And T is where a lot of people used to be. I find that there's fewer and fewer people around here. I find that our culture is moving in this direction. You've heard about new books, haven't you, by atheists, haven't you? Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. I mean, there's a number of them, and they're selling like crazy. So lots and lots of your neighbors and friends have read these books, which is, you know, written by people who were here at A. And a lot of people are moving in this direction. And so we're running into people, and we find in the beginning of our conversation that they're not a T, they're a D. They're at D, which is somewhere around the lines of, well, I don't know if there's a God. There probably isn't. But even if there was, I wouldn't believe it because I think Christians are idiots. And so if I can, in a conversation or a series of conversations or the way I live my life, make that person think, wait a minute, maybe there's something to this. I think that's tremendous. And I think if we can find ways to move people from D to E to F to G, that's tremendous. See, a lot of us learned how to share our faith. Maybe you haven't, but when I was in college and afterwards, I learned to ask people questions that always began with the phrase, if you were to die tonight. You know these questions? If you were to die tonight, how sure are you that you'd go to heaven? If you were to die tonight and stand before God and he were to say, why should I let you into heaven, what would you say? Now, those are great questions if you're talking to someone at about here, T. Because the question is loaded with assumptions, isn't it? It assumes that they really do believe in God. It assumes that they believe in heaven. It assumes that something they could possibly say to that question might get them into heaven or might not get them into heaven, and that God is a personal God who would talk to them, and God is a God who would judge them on the basis of some sort of standard of righteousness. It's got all sorts of assumptions that used to be the assumptions our society is built on. But for people, and so when you meet someone like that and you have a conversation, you find out, and that's a great question to ask. But if they're like my relatives who are at like negative W, I think. No, if they're at like D or something, you start any question at all with, if you were to die tonight, what are they thinking? They're thinking, what is with you Christians? You're always talking about death. It's so morbid. It's so depressing. Why are you always talking about, are you trying to sell me life insurance or something? What's going on? I find that those if you were to die tonight questions are not the best for people who are here. I find I need to have another set of questions. Like, you ever think much about spiritual stuff? You ever read any good stuff about religion or God or the afterlife? What kind of stuff has shaped your thinking? Who influences the way you see the world? Those kinds of questions. Now, they may answer that question and tell you that they've been thinking about it a ton. They've even been reading their Bible. They're just not quite sure what to make of it. And they're at why? Hallelujah. Well, so great. Well, now I got some things to say to you. Or they may tell you that Christopher Hitchens' book was the best book they've ever read. And, you know, they're going around trying to sell the book to other people because they think it's great. And anybody who believes in God is crazy. Okay, well, now we got to have a different kind of conversation. What I'm trying to say is we need to live with the reality that maybe in some cases moving people part of the way is a great victory. Here's two questions that I think are helpful for this, and then I'll quit. One question that I think is very helpful in this whole process is, isn't it possible that, and then you can fill in the blank there, isn't it possible that there might be a God? Isn't it possible that if this is when, this is a great series of questions to use when people talk about the Bible. They'll say, the Bible, it's just like any other book. You know, it's got all sorts of mistakes in it. People made changes, you know, along the way. Well, yeah, maybe. Isn't it possible, though, that if there is a God and he wanted to communicate to us, isn't it possible that he revealed truth and it got written down in a book? Isn't that at least possible? See, I'm trying to move them from no to yes, and I want to take them through the little wonderful world of maybe. Well, yeah, I guess if there is a God and he wanted to communicate, I guess so. And isn't it possible that when he had people write it down, he made sure that they got it right? Isn't that at least theoretically possible? A second question that's very helpful for this gradual approach is, how do you know that? Lots and lots of people in our world have very strong opinions about things that, they really don't have a great basis for having those strong opinions. They believe them very strongly, but they've never really wrestled with why. How do they know that? And so I find asking that, well, how do you know that? What convinces you of that? What makes you so sure? Is a very good way of dislodging some people who've been stuck in D or E or F for a long time, and then they can start, maybe I need to think about this. I've become a real strong believer in this whole thing because of conversations I've had with my mother. That's right, yes, my Jewish mother. And all those jokes you've heard about Jewish mothers, they're true, and they're not funny. So all that guilt stuff, years of therapy. Anyway, sorry. Okay, so, you know, a Jewish kid becoming a believer in Jesus and wanting to witness to his Jewish mother, there's a few obstacles there, you might guess. And for years, I tried the very direct, you know, approach. I sent my mother Bibles. I sent my mother a copy of the Jesus film. I sent my mother a copy of the Jesus film translated into Hebrew, even though my mother doesn't know a single word of Hebrew. I just thought it would be impressive. I sent all sorts of stuff. Nothing worked. Nothing. And then after years of trying and almost getting to the point of giving up, one time, this is probably now, 10 years ago already, I was on the phone with my mother, and she was telling me about a funeral that she had just been to. And it was a funeral of a man who was a teacher in the high school where I went to, where I grew up. And I knew this man, and he was a skeptic and an atheist, and he was pretty obnoxious toward people of any kind of faith. And he died after a very terrible, tragic illness. It just made him more angry and more bitter. He never came around. It was really very, very tragic. And my mother was telling me about the funeral, and she was trying to cheer up this man's grieving adult children who are now, you know, I guess in their 20s and 30s. And so she and these adult children had sort of accepted their father's atheism and skepticism. And so my mother, trying to cheer them up as kind of a religious person, my mother's philosophy was all religions are good. All people go to heaven. Everything works. Everything's nice. And so my mother said to these people, well, at least now your father's in a better place. And they rolled their eyes and they kind of walked away from her kind of rudely. And she was really insulted, and she was telling me this on the phone. And she says, you know, what do you think about, you know, I was trying to help them, you know, deal with their grief, and, you know, they just walked away from me. And so I was so tempted to preach a sermon, and I was so tempted to quote Bible verses and to make all sorts of pronouncements about this guy. And I finally thought, well, no, just ask a question and then shut up. And so I said, well, Mom, how do you know that? What? Well, how do you know he's in a better place? What? Well, Mom, you said at least now he's in a better place. It sounds like you're really sure of that. What? How do you know that? What makes you so sure? See, no one had ever really challenged my mother that way. And so there was a long pause. And let me tell you, Jewish mother guilt can be communicated in silence as well as with words. And I knew I was feeling it. And finally, my mother said, well, I guess I don't know. And I wanted to jump up and down. See, for years, my mother had been in concrete with everybody's okay, every religion's good, there is no right and wrong, who are we to judge, and all of that stuff that immobilizes and kills people. And nothing I had ever said had released her. And finally, she said, well, I guess I really don't know that. And I thought, well, I don't know what I said. I probably just said very little. I tried to get off the phone and let her be very bothered by that. No, really, I don't mean that as a joke. We need to allow people to be uncomfortable with their unworkable beliefs. And that started for my mother, my Jewish mother, an investigation where she started reading and thinking and questioning. When she was about 72 or 73, she bought herself her first computer and taught herself how to send email. And I started getting lots and lots of emails from my mother, most of which had musical attachments. And one day, so my mother starts asking me all these questions, and I'm starting to answer back with questions. And one day she writes to me, she says, I think I'm going to read the New Testament. Frame the email. just to let you in, Jewish mothers don't say that too often. Well, Mom, let me know how it goes, you know? And then she starts asking me questions. What did Jesus mean about this? Why did Jesus say this? What did I do? I answered a question with a question, of course. Well, what do you think he meant, Mom? Why do you think he said it? And back and forth, the emails would go for years until when my mom was 75, she became a Christian. 75! I have this beautiful... Oh, good, I'll tell her. I'll tell her you said that. I have this wonderful picture on my computer that I'll just pop up every so often when I feel like crying. It's my mother at age 75 being baptized. By my brother. That's another whole story. He was like, whoa! See, this stuff, it may take some time. It may take some wrestling, but it is worth it. There's great, great benefit from learning to ask some questions, to listen. You got to listen. You got to really ask God to give you compassion and concern for people. Don't just pray, oh, Lord, give me the right thing to say. But Lord, give me a heart to love these people, to know what I could ask that will just get them moving in the right direction. Isn't that a wonderful thing?